Welcome to Random Review on this beautiful day. You must be the real book lovers to be here in such gorgeous weather. I think we'll make it worth your while. I'm Connie Georgiou, and along with Deborah Goldenberg, who's in the back, we coordinate the Random Review program, which is sponsored by Friends of the Library. We also have some community sponsors. Grassroots provides books for our reviewers. Northwest Graphic Imaging makes our posters. Trader Joe's donates our flowers. And we have our newest sponsor, Allen Brothers Coffee Roasters, which now has invented a special blend of coffee. You'll see the sign back there. You are drinking Library Blend. So next time you're at an Allen Brothers establishment, you can ask special for this blend and see if they really have more of it. For anybody who misses this, who's out on their bicycle instead, there will be a podcast available at the library website shortly. I just want to thank everybody who participated in the big book sale, which was a great success. You may have been there volunteering or purchasing, and it was wonderful. Thank you very much. Next month's review is going to be another great one. It's going to be Wednesday, April 9th, Jonathan Haidt's book. This is a very thought-provoking one, The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. That's a really hot topic. And our reviewer will be Courtney Campbell, who is the Hunter Professor in Religion and Culture in the OSU Philosophy Department. And now it's going to be my pleasure to introduce Beth Rietveld, who will be our reviewer for The Roundhouse. You know, often when I call people, when I first contact them to see if they will review a book for us, some of them they're not familiar with the book and they're a little hesitant at first. But when I got a hold of Beth and asked her if she would be willing to review The Roundhouse, she said, you know, at this very moment, I'm immersed in that book, and yes. So I think we have the right person here. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Beth and her background. As many of you know, she had a long career at OSU. She was at OSU starting in 1980, and she only recently retired. So she was there 32 years. And she's most well known for the last 18 years of that period, when Beth was the longest serving director of the OSU Women's Center, which provides educational programs, referral to resources on campus, off campus, provides a social setting, setting for discussions for women as well as men. But even before that, Beth was instrumental in forming the university's Faculty Women's Network, which provides a forum for sharing common concerns, structured to address university-wide issues of gender. And that's where I first met her. Probably every woman who is on the faculty at OSU has had something to do with that organization. And Beth also played a role in the President's Commission on the Status of Women at OSU. As the Women's Center Director, I want to tell you about this course that Beth invented and launched, and it's called Women's Leadership Initiative. Students have to be nominated to take this course. And in the course, it's designed around making goals and working towards seeing how you could achieve those goals. And her poster child, one of her poster children for that course, is the young woman who took that course and planned her goals and went on to be elected as the president of ASOSU, the student organization, based on the goals that she made in that class. But Beth's accomplishments are recognized well outside listen to me, Columbus. I've been at every OSU in the country, so I get my cities and universities mixed up sometimes. In 2011, Beth was honored as the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Women's, the National Women's Studies Association. And this is a very high national honor. Statewide, the organization Oregon Women in Higher Education recently created a new award in Beth's honor. And this award is called the Beth Rietveld Award for Outstanding Service to Oregon Women in Higher Education. And its purpose is very interesting. It's to inspire in other people Beth's spirit of dedication, leadership, and activism. Locally, Beth has served on the board of the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. She's currently the president of the Mary's River Quilt Guild. Now she's retired, so she actually has time for some other things, and she spends time now on quilting and participating in fiber arts groups. She hikes in McDonald Forest, and of course, reading. So let's welcome Beth Rietveld.
Thank you, Connie. Because of the subject matter in this book, I want to take just a brief moment to introduce Letitia Wilson, who's the executive director of the Center Against Rape and Domestic Violence. And I want her just to say very quickly what CARDVA does. I'm sure that a lot of people in this room already know about CARDVA.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so glad to be here today. So we provide services for people that have experienced domestic violence or sexual assault, and we also provide leadership and education in the community. So this is who we are. Most people recognize us from our brochure. I left some brochures in the back, and I will be sitting in the back of the room if anybody is impacted by the subject matter. And we have a 24-hour hotline number on these materials that you can call to get support or just to talk about anything if you're impacted today.
Thanks.
Thank you. You're
welcome. Thank you. So when Connie called me, I had just started reading The Roundhouse, and of course I was enthusiastic about it, even though the subject matter is a difficult topic to read about. So I want to give you a little bit of background, both about Louise Erdrich, the author, and I would like to know how many people have not read the book. Okay. I will try my hardest not to give away anything that happens at the end of the book. But I will be talking a little bit about what happens right at the beginning of the book, so I'm not giving away anything by bringing up the subject matter. But let me tell you first about Louise Erdrich. This is her 14th novel. She's an enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians, a band of Anishinaabe, also known as Ojibwa and Chippewa. Her 2009 novel, The Plague of Doves, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction. And in November of 2012, she received the National Book Award for Fiction for The Roundhouse. She also owns a small independent bookstore called Birch Bark Books in Minneapolis that focuses on Native American literature. She's written mostly about Native American issues in her books. So let me give you a little overview of the characters so that you know kind of who's in this book. The book takes place in 1988 on the Ojibwa Reservation in North Dakota. Joe, a 13-year-old boy, is the narrator of the book. His mother, Geraldine Coots, is a tribal enrollment expert who records births, bloodlines, and enrollment for every child born. And the book says whether of incest, molestation, rape, adultery, beyond the reservation, or within. So she takes care of enrollment for everyone that's born within the Indian reservation. And his father, Basil, is a tribal judge. Maybe it's Basil. Basil. I'll call him Basil. He's a tribal judge. Joe being the narrator, it's really interesting to see this story through a 13-year-old boy's eyes. And you learn a lot about sort of the coming of age of 13-year-old boys. There's, like any 13-year-old, he and his friends are obsessed with Star Trek, The Next Generation. They sneak beer and, drink that. which they're not supposed to do, but they do it anyway. They obsess about sex and relationships. Other characters in the book include Joe's alcoholic and sometimes violent Uncle Whitey and his former stripper girlfriend, Sonia. There's a priest named Father Travis, who's an ex-Marine, and a grandfather, Musham, who tells long involved stories in his sleep. And his best friends are Cappy, Zach, and Angus. Now, there are other characters through the book, but those are sort of the main characters. So I'm going to start, I'm going to read a short passage from the very beginning of the book so that you kind of, it sets the scene just a little bit. Joe is talking with his father, and his father asks, "Where is your mother?" His voice was hoarse and dry. I slid the book onto another chair, rose, and handed him my glass of water. He gulped it down. He didn't say those words again, but the two of us stared at each other in a way that struck me somehow as adult, as though he knew that by reading his law book, I had inserted myself into his world. His look persisted until I dropped my eyes. I'd actually just turned 13. 2 weeks ago, I had been 12. "At work," I said, to break his gaze. I had assumed that he knew where she was and that he got the information when he phoned. I knew she was not really at work. She had answered a phone call and then told me that she was going to her office to pick up a folder or two. A tribal enrollment specialist, she was probably mulling over some petition she'd been handed. She was the head of the Department of One. It was a Sunday, thus the hush. The Sunday afternoon suspense, even if she'd gone to her sister Clemence's house to visit afterward, Mom would have returned by now to start dinner. We both knew that. Women don't realize how much store men set on the regularity of their habits. We absorb their comings and goings into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones. Our pulse is set to theirs. And as always, on a weekend afternoon, we were waiting for my mother to start us ticking away on the evening. And so you see, her absence stopped time. What should we do, we both said at once, which was again upsetting. But at least my father, seeing me unnerved, took charge. Let's go find her, he said. And even then, as I threw on my jacket, I was glad he was so definite. Find her, not just look for her, not search. We would go out and find her. So this is how it starts. And the husband and the son do find Geraldine, who's been beaten and raped. We don't know until midway through the book the circumstances about the attack, and we don't even know the identity of the attacker until quite late in the book. What we do know is that Geraldine had a pillowcase over her head and didn't know if the crime took place on state land or tribal land, who had committed it, an Indian or a non-Indian. Geraldine withdraws to her bedroom and will not eat or speak or bathe. She's so depressed, and she will not. She communicates very little with her husband and with her son. One of the things I want to say, and I did go through the CARDVA volunteer training, and one of the things that a lot of people will say, and in fact Joe says through the book, he wants his before mother back. He wants her to be the way she used to be. And I think one of the things that many of us who have never experienced violence in our lives don't understand about someone who is a victim of violence is that however they react is their reaction. It is true to them, and it is something that we have to accept. It can take weeks, it can take months, it can take years. And I think that's one of the things. A lot of people may say, well, why can't they just get over it? Well, you don't get over it. And each person's reaction, however that is their reaction, and they own that. And we need to honor that. So I just wanted to say that, because I think through this book, and through a 13-year-old's eyes, he doesn't understand why his mother is not the before mother. He wants the before mother back. I'm going to read another short passage here. Joe is trying to communicate with his mother, and she has withdrawn. He says, "Mom, I need to talk to you." "Nothing." "I need to talk to you," I said again. "I'm tired," she said. "You're always tired, but you sleep all the time." She didn't answer. "It was just a comment," I said. Her silence got to me. "Can't you eat? You'll feel better. Can't you get up? Can't you come back to life?" "No," she said immediately, as if she'd thought about this too. "I can't do it. I don't know why. I just cannot do it." Her back was still turned, and a slight tremor began in her shoulders. "Are you cold?" I stood and threw the blanket up over her shoulders, and then I sat back down in the chair. "I planted those stripy petunias you like. Here," I emptied my pockets of the little plastic identifying sticks, scattered them on the bed. Mom, I planted all sorts of different flowers. I planted sweet peas. Sweet peas? I hadn't really planted sweet peas. I don't know why I said it. Sweet peas, I said again. Sunflowers. I planted sunflowers. I hadn't planted sunflowers either. Sunflowers will get huge. She turned over in bed and stared at me. Her eyes were sunk in gray circles of skin. Mom, I've got to talk to you. About the sunflowers? Joe, they'll shade out the other flowers. Maybe I should plant them in another place, I said. I've got to talk to you. Her face dulled. I'm tired. Mom, did they ask you about that file? What? She stared at me in a sudden dread, her eyes riveted to my face. There was no file, Joe. Yes, there was. The file you went to get on that day you were attacked. You told me you went to get a file. Where is it? The dread in her face became an act of fear. I didn't tell you. You imagined that, Joe. Her lips trembled. She coiled in a ball, pulled her shrunken fist to her mouth, squeezed her eyes shut. Mom, listen, don't you want us to catch him? She opened her eyes. Her eyes were black pits. She did not answer. Mom, listen, I'm going to find him, and I'm going to burn him. I'm going to kill him for you. She sat up suddenly, activated, like rising from the dead. No, not you. Don't you. Listen, Joe, you've got to promise me. Don't go after him. Don't do anything. Yes, I'm going to, Mom. This jolt of strong reaction from her triggered something in me. I kept goading her. I'll do it. There's no one to stop me. I know who he is. I'm going to go out after him. You can't stop me because you're here in bed. You can't get out. You're trapped in here. And it stinks. Do you know it stinks in here? I went over to the window and was about to pull the shade up when my mother spoke to me. What I mean is my before mother, the one who could tell me what to do. She spoke to me. Stop that, Joe. I turned away from the window. She was sitting up. There was no blood in her face at all. Her skin had a pasty, sunless quality, but she stared at me and spoke in an even, commanding tone. Now you listen to me, Joe. You will not badger or harass me. You will leave me to think the way I want to think here. I have to heal any way I can. You will stop asking questions. You will not give me any worry. You will not go after him. You will not terrify me, Joe. I've had enough fear for my whole life. You will not add to my fear. You will not add to my sorrows. You will not be part of this. Well, for those of you who've read the book know that Joe didn't listen to his mom. And he and his friends become sort of amateur detectives. They decide that the legal system moves too slowly and in many cases is not fair to Native Americans. His father, the judge, turns to the law for answers, going over case files, trying to find any unusual cases that might have left somebody with a grudge against the family. And Joe really wants to solve the crime, so he and his three friends look for answers at the Roundhouse, which is a sacred space on tribal land. This is near where the crime took place, even though his mother doesn't know precisely where it took place. They follow several leads, and they discover clues that eventually can be used to identify the perpetrator. I want to say something about violence against women in Native American communities. I did a lot of research because the author had sort of an ulterior motive in writing this book. She wanted to show the scandal of many unprosecuted rapes of reservation Indian women. And one of the statistics I found is that indigenous women in the U.S. experience some of the highest rates of sexual assault in the country. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, nearly half of all Native American women have been raped, beaten, or stalked by an intimate partner. One in three will be raped in a lifetime. Now, the statistic for women in the U.S. is one in four, so it's a higher rate of sexual assault in the Native communities. And the women are murdered at a rate 10 times higher than the national average in Native American reservations. One of the other things about this book, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about jurisdiction and law related to this, but one of the things about this book is it shows generally a positive picture of the Ojibwa people. And the author doesn't hide the fact that there are problems of poverty and drinking on reservations. She does address that in some of her characters. She also talks openly about the marginalization and racism that happen on the outside of the reservation. She shows a sense of community that few of us will ever experience. The definition of family is not limited to blood relations within the Native American community. I'm going to read another passage briefly. One of the things about Native Americans that I've learned, both through my work at OSU and in going to powwows and some of the other things that I've experienced, is storytelling is a very important part of the culture. And there is a storyteller in this book. I'm going to tell you first how Joe finds himself in the room with Mushum, the grandfather, who is the storyteller. So he's gotten away from his home, and he's decided to stay with his uncle and aunt. And this is all part. I don't want to tell too much of the story, but he's decided to stay with his aunt and uncle. And so he goes into a room that he's supposed to sleep in, and this one touched me particularly. He said, I went off to Evie's room, and when I opened the door to the room, I saw the sewing machine wedged next to the bed, and the folded stacks of fabric, and the wallboard covered with hundreds of spools of bright thread. When I saw the quilt pieces and the shoebox labeled zippers and the same heart-shaped pincushion, only Mom's was dusty green, I thought of my father entering our sewing room every night and how the loneliness had seeped from under the door of the sewing room, then spread across the hall and tried to get into my bedroom. I said to Clemens, "You think it would bother Mushum if I bunked with him?" So he chooses not to sleep in the sewing room because it reminds him of his mom. And of course, anything about quilting, I pay attention to. So he shares the room with his grandfather, Mushum, who talks in his sleep. And he not only talks in his sleep, he tells stories in his sleep. And the stories are long and involved, and they go in all different directions. I got a little bit lost in some of the storytelling, but it all comes together at the end of the book. So you have to pay attention to the stories, even though they may not be in context as you're reading them, you don't fully understand. So grandfather tells stories in his sleep. Joe's ancestors have the beliefs that are transmitted through these stories. The tribe has a practice for handling Windigo. This is a person who's possessed by a spirit that would make him or her become an animal and see fellow humans as prey or meat. Eventually, Joe sees the man who hurt his mother as a Windigo and believes that justice must be served, especially since the attacker will never be tried through the legal system. And so I'm not going to go into great detail about the stories, but there is, through this story, is the concept of sort of justice against somebody who is harming others. Let's see. One other passage here. This is when Joe finally decides what he's going to do. He's riding in the car with his parents, and this is after his father has been hospitalized, but they're riding home. So he said, "During this ride of peace, so like my earliest memories of going places with my parents, it came to me what I must do. A thought descended into me as I lay beneath my own soft quilt. I pushed it out. The thought fell back. Three times I pushed it out, each time harder. I hummed to myself. I tried to talk, but my mother put her finger to her lips and pointed at my father, who was asleep. The thought came again, more insistent, and this time I let it in and reviewed it. I thought this idea through to its conclusion. I stood back from my thought. I watched myself think. The end of thinking occurred." So this is when, I'm not going to tell you what Joe does, but this is when he decides what he's going to do. And it does tie into the grandfather's stories. Another thing I found in doing a little bit of research on the book is there is a governor of South Dakota in the book who plans to adopt a young Native American girl. And it's kind of a turning point in the story. I didn't make this connection until I was doing research after reading the book. That the governor of South Dakota in the book was modeled after the real-life governor of South Dakota, Bill Janklow, Jankla was accused of raping a teenage Indian girl when he worked as a lawyer on the reservation. She was babysitting for his family and was his ward. And this is a true story. She didn't go public with the accusation at the time, although she told her principal at her school. After she made a public accusation, the case went nowhere. She died under mysterious circumstances. So this is another sign of the author being frustrated that justice does not is not carried out. So she designed one of her characters in the book who basically was trying to adopt a Native American girl. She painted him in kind of a negative light. And then there's a lot in this book about the plight of Indians in our country, starting from the very earliest times. And I just want to read a little bit about Indian rights. So the father is talking with the son about a law case. Take Johnson versus McIntosh. It's 1823. The U.S. is 47 years old, and the entire country is based on grabbing Indian land as quickly as possible in as many ways as can be humanly devised. Land speculation is the stock market of the time. Everybody's in on it. George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, as well as Chief Justice John Marshall, who wrote the decision for this case and made his family's fortune. The land madness is unmanageable by the nascent government. Speculators are acquiring rights on treaty-held Indian land, and the land still owned and occupied by Indians. White people are literally betting on smallpox. Considering how much outright grease is used to bring this unsavory case to court, a case pled by no less than Daniel Webster, the decision was startling. It wasn't the decision itself that still stinks, though it was the obiter dicta, the extra incidental wording of the opinion. Justice Marshall went out of his way to strip away all Indian title to all lands viewed or discovered by Europeans. He basically upheld the medieval doctrine of discovery for a government that was supposedly based on the rights and freedoms of the individual. Marshall vested absolute title to the land in the government and gave Indians nothing more than the right of occupancy, a right that could be taken away at any time. Even to this day, his words are used to continue the dispossession of our lands. But whatever particularly galls the intelligent person now is that the language he used survives in the law, that we are savages living off the forest, and to leave our land to us was to leave it useless wilderness, that our character and religion is of so inferior a stamp that the superior genius of Europe must certainly claim ascendancy, and on and on. So there's a lot in this book about the lack of rights that Native Americans have had throughout their lives. And the laws do not favor Native Americans. I look specifically at laws related to sexual violence. President Obama signed a Tribal Law and Order Act into law in 2010. It was an important moment of recognition. More recently, the Senate Judiciary Committee crafted a helpful piece of legislation, the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2012, would have given tribal nations limited jurisdiction over sexual predators, regardless of race. That's the key word there. Right now, tribal courts can only prosecute tribal members. The problem is that over 80% of the perpetrators of rapes on reservations are non-Native. Most are not prosecuted. The bill went forward only to stall in the House, blocked by Republican votes. Hate to say it, but that's one of the laws that never became in place. So they cannot have any kind of jurisdiction over a non-Native person, even if they commit a crime on reservation property. Overall, the book is a mystery. It's a thriller. It's a coming-of-age story about 13-year-old boys. It intertwines stories of the 13-year-old with his learning about sexuality. Again, I don't want to get too detailed, but he is fascinated with the ex-stripper who lives with his uncle. And I think one of the things that really struck me is how much this 13-year-old grew up in this book. One of the things we learn in the book is that he became an attorney as he became an adult, and I think that kind of you can see the seeds of that starting as a 13-year-old in finding out how justice can be served and how to investigate cases. And most importantly, he explores religion and relationships. There's a theme of religion through the book, especially with the priest that he gets to know. And the relationships of friends, how 13-year-old friends can be friends for life, that they can really come together and do whatever for each other. And lastly, that he wants to protect his mother by seeking justice. And I think it's a beautiful story of a family and how they come together in the end. So I loved reading the book. I'm not keen on the topic of the book. You know, the fact that you do learn a lot about sexual violence and you do learn a lot about the unfair situation for Native Americans. But overall, I think the story kept me riveted because I really did want to know what was going to happen next. And there are some twists and turns and surprises, and I will not tell you any of those. And I kind of want to open it up for discussion because I'm sure many of you have thoughts, many of you who have read the book have some thoughts that I probably haven't touched on, and maybe we could get a discussion going, or you may have some questions about some aspect of the book. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
I just have a quick comment. I was really touched by the respect that she has for teenage boys,
mm-hmm.
you know, which a lot of us who work with teenagers or know a lot of teenagers, you tend to sort of have a reservation or a fear
mm-hmm.
about teenage boys, and she just has a real respect for them
mm-hmm.
and their integrity, especially with each other.
Right.
And I thought that was great. She portrayed them.
One of the other things I learned, and I have not read her other books, but she often uses multiple narrators in her books, and in this book she just used one narrator, and it was the 13-year-old boy. Yes?
You made the jurisdiction thing complicated, which it is, but you said whether it occurred on state or reservation land can make a difference. But there's even a third factor, I think, if I remember right, federal lands.
Mm-hmm.
You've got three different choices, and if it's not on the right land, then
right.
Can't be prosecuted by the indigenous Americans.
Exactly, and the mother truly doesn't know where it took place. She was had something over her head. She did not know, and so there is a point in the story where the son asks the mother, "Why didn't you lie? Why didn't you say it happened on Native land? Or why didn't you know? It would have been easier to prosecute if she had lied." And she said, "I already told you the truth, and I told your father the truth, and I couldn't lie." Back here.
Would you please repeat the question?
Oh, I will, thank you. Yes?
As I recall in reading the book, the perpetrator, the attacker, knew exactly where the federal land was,
mm-hmm.
where the native land was, and that is why he kept moving her around as he was finding a place to rape her.
Right. The comment was the perpetrator did know the difference of the different parts of the property, and so he intentionally moved her around in order to keep it complicated. Yes.
She only used one narrator, but in a way she used two, because you have the older, with a certain amount of foreshadowing, you already know he's a lawyer, so you know a few things, and he brings things into it, you know, the older Joe.
Yes, exactly. You do hear from the grown-up Joe in the book. Yeah, and that was, I meant to repeat the comment, but you do hear from the younger Joe at 13, and then when he does become an attorney later, he is reflecting back. Yes?
It is rather brilliant that she uses a son as the narrator, because if you think if she had chosen to have a daughter, it would be an entirely different story altogether.
Exactly.
And it is a 13-year-old boy dealing with these basically women's issues is really quite brilliant.
Mm-hmm. The comment was, it's interesting that she used a boy in this story. If it had been a girl at 13, it would have been a completely different story. And I agree with that. Carmen.
I wonder why she picked 13 instead of 15, the way they were driving around on the reservation. It seemed to me they were more like 15-year-old boys than 13.
Yeah. The question was, the author made the character 13 instead of 15. I think, in my opinion, the fact that they were driving around made it more dangerous. I'll just put it that way. Carmen.
You made a comment when you started about the close relationships of among families and the strong community. There's a piece in the book where the boy is asking his father how he's related to one of his friends, and it's a complicated blood, you know, well, I think, you know, you're a quarter of a cousin. And it sounded as if there were guidelines for how you treat a brother versus a cousin versus a second cousin, and I wondered if you had any insight on that.
That's a tough question. I'll repeat the question, and maybe somebody else has an answer. Okay, tell me if I get this right, Carmen. Carmen mentioned that there are different types of relationships between cousins, and I think within the Native community, you can have a quarter part of you. I think that has a lot to do with the registration that the mother does, where she actually registers the birth, and it has to do with the percentage of your blood that is Native American blood. But I think also the fact that cousins are different than friends, and in a lot of ways in this book, it seems like everyone is related, even though, and I think that's also part of the close-knit community. But I'm not sure I can answer your question specifically, Carmen. I'm sorry. Does anyone else have anything they want to say about that? Shirley?
No, not about that.
Oh, okay.
I just wonder what your overall view of Erdrich's writing is in this book. Is she skilled or better than that, or what do you think?
I think she's extremely skilled, and I have to say that as I got started, I got sucked into the story. I got a little bit off track when it was the storytelling of the grandfather, because I didn't make the connection until later. So I had to go back and reread that in order to make the connection. But I think she's a remarkable storyteller, and the fact that there are so many characters that intertwine, their lives intertwine, and there are so many little interesting stories in this book that I'm not telling you about, but stories that relate to something that the boy finds that has, there's a long story connected to him finding some money. There's the stripper and something that she does with the grandfather for his birthday present. So each one of these little stories keeps the reader engaged. And I, until the very end, really wanted to know how it was going to end. It was not a book that I put down and thought, oh, I'm not going to make it. And I've done that with several books. This was a book I really wanted to find out how it was going to end.
The theme of justice throughout the whole book, even at the very end, which you can't talk about,
right.
But it's like the everyone knows, mm-hmm. but nobody's saying. So there's this, what is justice? It's not necessarily legal justice.
That's a good point. And there's also, I don't know whether this is in the research I did or in the book, but there's a difference between justice and vengeance. And I think that was mentioned in the book. And so this is not necessarily vengeance. It really is making a right out of a wrong, or making something just that through the legal system was not going to be just. That's an interesting point. And looking at how it all ends, and I'm not going to tell you how it ends, but looking at how it ends, you're left with a lot of questions.
The whole community knows.
And the whole community knows. Yeah. Yes?
One of the things I liked about the book is how packed it was. I mean, there were so many themes and so many things going on. But one of the, you mentioned the coming of age aspect of the book, but I thought one of the most powerful teaching things about the book was the deep and abiding love and friendship between the four boys, particularly Joe and Cappy.
Yeah.
And I expect to read that about adolescent girls, but not so much about adolescent boys, and I thought it was absolutely beautiful.
Mm-hmm. She said that the deep and abiding friendship and love between the four boys was really impactful. And I feel the same way. I think it's interesting that, you know, some of the trouble that they got themselves into and their whole sort of detective, you know, looking for clues at the scene of the crime. And then things that happened, you know, throughout the story. There was a very strong tie of friendship. And that was really, really beautiful.
When
yes.
I finished the book and then been watching Downton Abbey and the rape in Downton Abbey, and you get to some of the same questions about what's justice and what's revenge, and, you know, really similar type of analysis to the whole thing.
Exactly. And I can speak to Downton Abbey very well. No, it's a good point, because sometimes justice is not going to be served. Now, I'm not advocating violence in any way, shape, or form, but I think it's a good point.
Some similarities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Two things. I don't have the book with me right now, but I believe they talked about justice. Didn't say justice and vengeance, but two types of justice. Mm-hmm. There are two types of justice, and he went on to describe those two. And I also think that being 13 was on the cusp of adolescence, so at 15 it wouldn't have been as amazing. Their experiences wouldn't have been quite as amazing or revealing or new.
Right.
So I think 13 was perfect.
Yeah. Did everyone hear that? That being 13 is different than being 15 in this book, and that also that there were two forms of justice that were mentioned in the book. And I don't have those specific, but I marked a lot of passages, but I didn't mark that one. Yes?
I think it's necessary to keep in mind when we're talking about adolescent boys that 13-year-old Native American boys on a reservation are quite different from 13-year-old Anglos in an urban setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think the former are possibly more capable, mm-hmm. more resilient, certainly or possibly more in tune with the natural world around them,
mm-hmm.
More used to handling tools and weapons, and driving.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in the boondocks, and I learned to drive when I was 12.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's an excellent point. And also, one of the things that Joe was exposed to, besides, I mentioned poverty and alcoholism, but there's also domestic violence in this book, and he is witness to his aunt and uncle involved in domestic violence situations.
I thought one of her most brilliant devices in the book was the very first paragraph where Joe and his father are weeding the plants that are trying to destroy the very foundation of their house. And you know right away that mm-hmm. you've got to find out what's going to destroy try to destroy the foundation of this family.
Right.
I thought that was it was a beautiful passage.
Yes. Yes, I'll repeat that, because I noticed that too. At the very beginning of the book, the father and son are pulling out these little seedlings of trees that are trying to destroy the foundation of the house. And that comes back later in the story as well. They bring that up again. So it's the symbolism of pulling out the seedlings that are destroying the foundation of the house, and at the same time, we know something is going to harm the foundation of their family. And that happens very quickly in the first chapter. Yes?
So in the little summary of this book in the library catalog, it mentions that she's continuing the trilogy that she began with the Plague of Doves. Do you know what the third part is?
No, and actually, I read an interview with Louise Erdrich, and she said, if I reveal what's happening in the third, it's like, she made some comment about, I'm not gonna say it right, so I'm not gonna repeat it, but she would not reveal anything. But in the Plague of Doves, she uses the character of the tribal judge, the father in this story, is a character in her book in 2009. So there is going to be a third book, but she wouldn't reveal it in her interviews, so I don't know it. But that is true. Yes?
You didn't mention her marriage to Darth. They wrote many books together in her early career.
Right. Now, I didn't do a lot of background into that, but did everyone hear that?
No.
Louise Erdrich was married to Michael
Darth.
And they did write books together. But they are no longer together, I believe. Oh, he did. Okay. Sorry. No, I didn't do a lot of background into that, but I was aware of that. Yes?
One of the interviews I read when I was reading the book was with her, and she and I had heard that Michael Doris had been accused of child abuse by one of the children. But another child accused both of them of child abuse.
Hmm. Interesting. I'm not aware of that, the child abuse or the any of that.
This was just in an interview.
Okay.
And she kind of glossed
over it.
She didn't want to enter into that discussion.
Okay. Yes?
Well, they did adopt a son with fetal alcohol syndrome, so she certainly was very aware of all of these issues.
Okay.
And after her husband was accused of child abuse, he committed suicide. So,
okay.
So, she certainly has a history of dealing with some very, very serious issues.
Okay. I'll repeat that because not everyone probably heard that. She and her husband adopted a child who had fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was after the husband had been accused of child abuse that he committed suicide.
He also wrote The Broken Cord.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He wrote The Broken Cord, and I'm not familiar with that book.
That's about fetal alcohol.
Okay.
Raising a fetal alcohol child.
Great. Okay. Any other questions or comments? John?
I get the impression that many in the audience have read this book.
Mm-hmm.
And to those who have not read it, would you recommend that they do read it?
I definitely would recommend it.
Yes.
The writing, as Shirley asked, the writing is, it will pull you through. It's not a type of novel that that you find boring, and there are generally, I think I would recommend it to anyone. If you have any kind of sexual assault knowledge in your own life or in a family member's life, it will be hard to read parts of the book. And I just sort of forewarn you that there's some really brutal and graphic descriptions about midway through the book. But I also think it's an important book to be read because I think we need to do what we can to make people more aware of services that are available. We've mentioned CARDVA at the beginning of the program. I mentioned it at the end because I think it's very important for us to know that we do have great services in our community. I also think that somebody asked me if this was a book that a child should read. And I was thinking that a teenager probably should read the book. I don't think it is a book that I would keep away from a 13, 14, 15-year-old child. Anything younger than that might be a little bit hard, but I think because the narrator is a 13-year-old, and because the subject matter is about culture, it's about family, it's about life, I think it's a book that, with some discussion from parents or from people in a school setting, I think it's worth reading.
I guess I would say, if to recommend it to somebody, I would say it's a good read. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's a good read. Mm-hmm. And as you're reading, you become aware of all of these issues that you should be devastated by. But it's a good read.
Yeah.
So you become aware of this incidentally,
mm-hmm.
because you're so gripped by the whole thing. So
right.
It's marvelous.
Thank you. Yes.
I think it's worth repeating that the law should be changed.
Yeah.
Yes. And the law, as I was saying, is recent law, so the laws definitely should be changed. And if we have an opportunity to speak up on behalf of doing things right, I think we ought to do that, or talk to the people who make the laws. No other questions? Thank you so much for coming. Thank you.